Access number 29039, Mr. Alan Pollock, Reel 6. Now, so what's the next stage? And I mean, we're moving through. We've done three. You said you had four aircraft. Perhaps we ought to look at the fourth. That we've had the Chipmunk, the Provost, and the Bailey. What was the fourth?
Well, the fourth aircraft that came in was the Vampire. And the Vampire was just arriving. Yep, the Vampire. I'm trying to think whether they were first or second. We're probably the second course down. So I think the one above us was on Vampires 2. But I'm not too certain about
now
that.
Now, what was the Vampire? Because people don't know.
And the Vampire was the... we had two Vampires. We had the side-by-side Vampire T-11 trainer, which you learned on. And then quite quickly you went solo and you only did 15 minutes, I think, or 20 minutes on the... on the Vampire T-11, and then there were so many of the Vampire 5s about then, because they'd come off. Vampire 5 was a single-seater version of the Vampire. That's right, the jet aircraft, and it had a Goblin engine, and it was the first centrifugal type, very big engine, and it was a twin-boom aircraft, and largely made of wood. It was quite a lightweight thing, but it was still did very well. It was as a fighter and even as a fighter bomber.
And what was it like to fly? I mean, what's your first jet aircraft?
It was quite thrilling, really. Even after the Balliol, it was so completely different. And in
now
many
what,
ways,
in
it
what
was.
Ways did it differ? I mean,
well, for starters, on the good side, you had absolutely no problem about torque, but you had a different problem with the Vampire. And that was the fact that you had to be smooth, and you had to always think if you were completely throttled back because you were coming in on too fast an approach or had got too much height with your flap down and you'd throttled back completely, you had to remember that you had 7.5 seconds, between 7.5 and it could be even as much as 9 before all your power would come on, and then it would come on in a bit of a belt. There'd be a lot of power coming on, whereas the later Jet Provost, when it came in, was very good in that respect. It was very very student friendly in terms of the throttle movement, and you didn't have that problem, because that was one of the worries that people had about jet aircraft. And obviously you accelerated better, more easily. I think landing generally was easier because you were always on a runway then, although the Vampires were flown off grass, but it wasn't something that one did normally. It was more for exercise than that. And markedly affected by the use of the flap. I mean, the full flap on the Vampire was very marked, because without putting your flap down, you wouldn't stop at all. So a flapless, if you ever had to do a flapless landing, you'd have to stop cock, you know, and be towed off the runway. Not that would happen too much, but they were pretty reliable. But one of the problems was pulling too tight again, even though it wasn't really a swept wing aircraft and its wing loading wasn't that high. You still had to be careful of. Particularly in crosswind, where you were being blown in towards the runway with a crosswind from the left, you were doing a left-hand circuit, and you over-tighten, because it was exactly the same thing. Quite a few Vampires were lost on recoveries from dive bombing attacks and things like that, people snatching, pulling too hard, and that was what was called the high-speed stall. And that was where, you probably know, there's a simple, really... If you pull 4G, your stall speed is the square root of that, and it's double. So in other words, that gives you 2, and that's twice. If you pull 4G, your stalling speed has gone up by double the square root of the amount of G that you're pulling, which means that you can stall at very high speed, and that's you could actually feel that. And again, one was demonstrated that, or... learn very quickly.
How would you get out of that?
And normally, I mean, you'd be at altitude when this would happen, and you just release the pressure from your stick, and the Vampire is very forgiving in a way. And intriguingly, all the speeds were remarkably similar to the Balliol. By complete coincidence, you could almost have similar speeds in your head for going round the corner, which was what we talked about going round on finals turn, and that, and the stalling speed. You know, you were sort of 85 knots or so, and your low speed handling and that. So in some ways it wasn't a great shift forward on that, apart from that obviously the Vampire was faster in a straight line. Before I left there, and before I got my wings, I had a total failure in the Mark 9, because we had Mark 9s. I shouldn't have mentioned Mark 5s. At Cranwell we only had Mark 9s, and Mark 9 was the modified Mark 5, which had come back from the Middle East, and some from the Far East, with tropicalization on it, and it meant it got a lot more load on its generators. And I once was sent up, and I mean there was no reason why I shouldn't have been, in quite thick cloud, and in the middle of this thick cloud, it was up to about 20,000 feet, probably 19,000 feet from about 2,000 feet broken to start with and then solid, and I had a complete electrics failure on the instruments, and twice I was really, I'd lost control, and if I'd had an ejection seat, I would have ejected, but I was very grateful.
Well, you lost your instruments, but did you lose
your... I had my master in, all that was left, my horizon went, my turn and slip tends to overread because of the you know, when you lose control of your master instruments and all that lot toppled in to start with, it's, you're not able to pick it up. But I was very grateful for the amount of instrument flying that I'd been given by two instructors that really took instrument flying seriously, because I think they've saved my life. I think that's, you know, the advanced.
Why was it so dangerous that your instruments didn't work? I mean, I know, but can you explain? For
well, the artificial horizon is such a key thing in cloud, and you get false senses of which way up you are, and my speed was going right up, so it was turning into a spiral dive, and then by the time you'd sorted out and got your wings roughly level, and then you were pulling your turn indicator, which is roughly working, but only roughly. Once you get G on it, it over indicates, so it's very difficult for you to know when your wings are actually level when you haven't got your master instrument, which was your artificial horizon, and all you'd got really was your DI, which would be spinning any rate, you know, and wasn't much use to you, and your airspeed indicator would just be telling you how fast you were going. And I can, because I'd practiced what we call then climbing twizzles, and for some reason when the Jet Provost came in, that exercise went out. But this was a very valuable exercise for all types of flying, where you just had to climb at a set rate of climb, and you had to turn at rate one or rate half, and you had to turn at a given rate and climb up through a certain amount of height. So you'd be climbing at 2,000 or 4,000 feet a minute, and then you'd be descending at 2,000 or 4,000 feet a minute, and you'd be turning at the same time. And that was a very good exercise for what we called scanning, and that was getting used to the fact that it was very easy to get transfixed and just looking at one instrument, and that was wrong. You always had to keep your eyes going round and round all the time, absorbing what all six were giving you, your master instruments, and that was the right way. And then it was sort of change, check, hold, trim, adjust, retrim, and that was your sort of procedure. Yes, and I was just very fortunate, really, because the second time I lost control twice in the cloud, and the second time I came out of the top of the cloud, I can remember vividly to this day, it was 18,500 feet. And I think I had about 80 knots on the clock, and I was going in and out of the top of the cloud, accelerating at, 3 knots a fortnight, I think, so slowly, and was convinced I was going to flick because I just got no thrust up there, and I was going in and out of the cloud tops, and I really thought if I go in again, I'd been so terrified before, although in theory you could get out, you knew at speed without an ejection seat that it was difficult.
Did you have an ejection
seat? No, not in the little 9. The 11.
The 9 is the trainer, isn't it?
No, the 9's a single seat.
So it's not.
No, that was the fighter version.
Right.
So it was lovely. You were just all by yourself, but there was no ejection seat in that. The 11 started with no ejection seats in, and then quite quickly it had ejection seats in, and that was a marked improvement.
Were you trained in ejection seats? I mean, did you actually have a go at it ever, or was it just something that was shown?
Well, they fired you up a trainer, which you probably saw at Farnborough yourself, where you practiced the kind of drill that Martin Baker, I believe, produced it, but it might have been produced by someone else, I really don't know, but you just were fired up with a blank sort of round just to give you the idea of pulling the face blind down. And to start with, there were just on the ejection seats, there were just the face blind, and then you ended up with one between your knees as well, because if you're in a high-speed aircraft and there was a lot of G, and that you couldn't always get your arms easily up to your face blind ejection seat, which was above your helmet, and you had to pull it round and down. And for that reason, for speed, you had the secondary ejection seat handle between your knees or right by your crutch that you just pulled up. And that ejection seat did save a tremendous number of lives, as you know. And that was because I when I went off my first tour,
I know you went to the canal, the Mediterranean, the canal zone. Should we finish the flying before we go to that? I mean, how did you actually pass out?
At Cranwell.
Yes. I mean, what was the final examination?
Well, you had a final handling test normally, and that was, well, invariably before your wings. Ours was slightly skew-whiff, although I'm pretty certain we all did have a final check, because there'd be checks all the way through. There was always some, after going solo, the next thing you had to worry about after what we're talking about, this consolidation, was the 25-hour check, and then there'd be your instrument flying check a little later on, and then you'd be at your night flying stage, and really it was going through all those aircraft in a similar way. But what it did allow me, and I think probably the others, was to really, we were fortunate that a new aircraft didn't fuss us, because we got used to having to learn at an early stage. And really all aircraft, I mean, there's not that much you really need to know about any aircraft to get it back on the ground. It's a different thing to sort of operate it well and operate it in terms of every available emergency. Our wings were given, I think, the night before we passed out, from memory. So we literally had our wings up on the final parade. But ours were a bit synthetic, because although we'd done quite a lot of flying, we hadn't completed our jet flying. So we went off to Swinderby.
I'll come to that. That's where you went to number 8 flying training school.
Yeah.
Now, before we go, how come you'd been to the Middle East? Because you seem to have gone and visited.
I was very lucky, yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, I was just extremely fortunate, because there I was, I just started my flying, and then this available slot came up for 4 of us, and 2 came from 2 entries higher than us, at 65 entry, and Hugh Rigg and myself were sort of number 3 and number 4, and we were able to go off down and see what was happening down in Kenya on the Mau Mau.
Who were you being detached to? Because you seem to have gone to the Mediterranean Fleet and the canals. Is that just on the way?
Well, the Mediterranean fleet was later. In the middle of I might have got the dates wrong then, because I've cross checked it. But
what's first?
It was the summer. Went down to the canal zone through. First of all, I went off to Lynham. The four of us sort of found our way to Lynham and stayed as ever then, which you did at the transit place, which was Cliff Pipard or Cliff Pippard, P-Y-P-A-R-D, and I think C-L-Y-F-F-E, Cliff Pipard, which is still there as a little village, and I don't think the transit camp, maybe there's nothing left of it there now, but that used to be the transit place that you stayed overnight, and then you went to Lynham, and we went off on the Hercules, sorry, the, I'm dozing a bit, in the Hastings, the four-engine Hastings to Lucca. And interestingly, I didn't mention, but just before my first solo, just before my very first flight, in fact, we had a mag drop and turned back. So I taxied out. This was for my first ever flight in a chipmunk to get dual, and we had to go back to dispersal in exactly the same way. They had mag drop problems on the Hastings, which, you know, that's the last thing you do really, is your mag checks and your first and secondary systems, your backup. So we had to wait. I'm pretty certain we waited an extra day before we went off to Lucca, and then from Lucca on down to we landed at Faid in the canal zone. And then we were there, I think, probably a day and a half, something like that. There was some sort of problem, too, with the next stage, which was a Valletta going down to Wadi Halfa, Khartoum, and then Eastleigh. And this was VHF trouble we had with the Valletta. But that was a marvellous flight, and I was so fortunate to be able to do that as a youngster, really. And
do you remember much about the flight out?
Well, it was very exciting at that young age to go off, on that long flight. The Hastings I was very impressed with, really, because it was very high off the ground. You know, when you, as you know, it's a tailwheel aircraft, and they allowed us up the front to do a little bit of flying on it. Both ways, and likewise with the Valletta, and I can remember, you know, how splendid it was to see Malta, and then also landing at Faid, because I think we landed at Faid quite in the sort of 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and it was really very, very hot, rather like today.
What you went to Eastleigh, did you say? What was the place at
Eastleigh? Yeah,
where
it was,
you were based?
That was Nairobi. There were two.
Is it Eastleigh?
There was Embakasi and Eastleigh were the two. And we actually landed in the Valletta. We landed on the Murrum runway. It was still Murrum in those days, or that particular runway was. And Eastleigh really became Nairobi.
Eastleigh.
Just like Eastleigh by Southampton, E-A-S-T-L-E-I-G-H. Yeah.
Was that where you were based, Eastleigh?
Yes, and we actually flew from there because the Lincolns were down there and the Harvards.
Now, what was the situation, before we go on to the flight, what was the situation in Kenya? Were you aware of the Mau Mau situation?
Oh, yeah. The Mau Mau had really sort of sprung up in the last year, 18 months before, and also we were privileged first to go off into the, I'm pretty certain we went off into the bush first, and on a sort of safari with a rather duff A70 safari vehicle that really had quite a lot of problems with the engine.
Tell us about that.
And that was really just a see the wildlife. I remember because I did a somewhat similar thing later when I was in Aden, down from Aden, but we went down through Namanga and right down into the sort of Maasai area, and then into, I'm pretty certain it was the Amboseli we were in back then too.
And how many would go on this safari?
Well, there were the four of us. That was Robin Brown. He ended up an engineer, this bloke, after a serious car accident that happened to him later. And a guy called Bell, Tinkle Bell, who was also on 60... Sorry, David Azan, Tinkle Bell. So there were three of them. Sorry, there must have been five of us. And Hugh Rigg and myself.
And what do you remember of the safari? I mean, that's a completely new experience.
Well, it was lovely. Yeah, it was really splendid to be able to sort of go and see lion at close quarters. And my big memory then too was there were three or four lions there, and we couldn't get this car started, and we wondered what on earth we'd do. And the battery was sufficiently strong that we starter motored it away from where the lions were.
Because now, wasn't there a risk of you being attacked by the very Mau Mau? I mean, by the Mau Mau?
Not really, no. They were in certain areas there. You're right that in some places there was a threat from that, but often they were as much of a threat to, sadly, to their own people, and often that's the way it worked.
And so you went on this safari. How long was it about?
Well, I think it was just probably five or six days, if that. And we had problems with the vehicles, as I said, but it was still marvellous to see. And even more when I got back, because we drew straws or tossed for it, and I was able to fly in one of the Harvards on one of their strike sorties. That was 1340 flight. 1340 flight were a small flight of armed Harvards.
Tell me about this sortie.
It was remarkably long. It was a 2.5 hour sortie that we went off on the Harvard, which is a long one. And it had light bombs. Yeah, in the back. That's right, of an operational strike. I think the guy's name was Taylor from memory. I did both sorties on the same day, so I was very fortunate. So after the Harvard sortie in the early morning, it went off quite early on.
Now, what do you remember of that first sortie?
A remarkable amount of game there to fly over the game, because to start with, they flew in formation, the other Harvard that was with us, and then dropped down low level and flying over these tremendous herds of game. It was really quite remarkable, you know, zebra, elephant, herds of elephant, and a whole variety all over that plain. And then we flew up to the attack area, which was slightly had cloud, slight cloud, wisps of cloud near the target.
Now, what was the target?
The target, I think, was just an area that I think, I'm pretty certain they'd dropped some smoke canisters, or they'd been dropped earlier, that was firing in a certain area of forest where one imagines they knew that, because they were largely trying to drive people out or back into the forest.
It wasn't a village or an identified town, just in an area of country.
No, and it likewise also with the Lincoln, when I flew in the Lincoln later.
Is that the same day?
It was
day
a similar. Yes, it was in that afternoon. And the Lincoln, as you know, was a modified Lancaster with the same highly developed later Merlin engines. And that was, again, they were dropping up in the forest areas. They were bombing, and I imagine also it was linked with, perhaps with, they were striking a particular area a forest.
Could you see the effects of the bombs? Or
no, no.
How high were you bombing from?
I honestly can't remember, but I imagine it wasn't that high, although, of course, you were already high because Eastleigh was... You started being high up on the equator there too, which meant that part of the reason the climate was so pleasant there, because you were already at quite a high altitude. And that was, again, one of the reasons, you know, that different aircraft, because of that height, the Harvards were found to be more useful than the Vampires down there.
Now, you were just a passenger on
the
flight.
Yes, on both. No, that's right.
And you enjoyed it?
Oh, yes, yeah. And I felt, you know, as I just turned 18, how fortunate I was, really, to be down there and to witness these sort of operational strikes. I think they were loosely connected, but not that connected with ground force work. I think it was more denial of supplies in the headquarters area where they thought the Mau Mau were at that stage. And it was kind of almost an area denial thing. And there were no real key targets on either of them that you could see. It was just an area of forest.
Now, what about when you got back? What were you doing at Eastleigh? Back to the base at Kenya. What were you doing at Eastleigh?
Well, I think we were briefly shown around, but not that much there, because obviously they got their own jobs to get on with, the various people, and it was a transport base, as you know, and not too far away from there is the... because I can remember being at that place where you're at the triangle of... where you're exactly halfway between the Cape and Cairo. I think it is Namanga, but I might be wrong about that. But I can remember being at that halfway point where it was signpost both ways to the Cape and to Cairo. And, that was a really remarkable experience.
Anything else happened on the trip, or how long did it take? I mean,
going down, I suppose, probably took 3.5 days, I'd have thought, with including the problems with serviceability in that. We went down on the one day from, once we got off from Faid, just through Wadi Halfa, did we stay in Khartoum?
But how long were you there? I mean, it seems that...
I can tell you exactly how long... Probably takes me just a minute to find that.
Okay.
I see on the 2nd of August we had the mag drop problem.
And it's August
1954, yeah. And I've got the names here. It was David Azan, Tinkle Bell, Hugh Rigg, and this guy, Jock Brown, that I was with. So there were five of us all together. And on the flight down from Lynham, we flew just virtually over Paris, down through Istria, Sardinia, into Lucca. Then we had the mag drop problem at Lucca in Malta, so that delayed us. And then we took off rather late for Faid and got to Faid at 3:30 in the morning when we landed. And then 206 squadron, I see, were down there. And we went down in a 116 squadron. Valletta, we had the problem with the VHF then. We had two testing flights up to Cairo and ended up staying the day, so we were delayed on the 5th. That was Thursday the 5th, and then I see we went off on the Friday to Wadi Halfa, the desert strip, and then we stopped in Khartoum because I see that we actually... I've got some things that we actually were shown, Gordon's plaque and the Mahdi's tomb and the Kitchener statues and Gordon's statue there on our way down. And I'm trying to think of the... Maybe I haven't got it here, the date I thought we had. The number of days.
Oh. It doesn't matter. Was it a month? The
marvellous thing I remember, though, was going down, and initially
the length of time it took us to fly over the Sud, you know, the swampland area in northern Sudan and further south in Sudan, and then the scrub country as you approached Kenya.
Now, hang on, we're sort of backtracking now. We're actually getting further away from the point. We've actually got you there. You've been on the raids, but
The raid was on the 20th of August 1954, so if we left on the 5th, that we obviously had a fortnight between the canal zone and being down there,
and
we were coming back, that's right. So the Friday, the 20th of August.
There, roughly?
Well, that would be 15 days, wouldn't it?
So that was the last thing you did, then you went back to
And I've got, it's
so
quite
was
right.
The point of this? I mean, it seems an awful long way to fly you down for 3 or 4 days.
Well, obviously, you were just going down the circuit, and it was something that was laid on, and there were we were just very lucky to be on that particular thing, because the next year I was fortunate, or even at the tail end of that year, to get down to the Mediterranean as well with the Mediterranean fleet.
Now, what do you remember of that?
Well, my big memory of that is being able to swim in the middle of the Mediterranean and actually swimming off an aircraft carrier, and the day and night operations of the aircraft, particularly the vivid memory of the landings on, you know, because you could, if you were down below, you could hear the thump as they arrived on.
Which aircraft?
They were Seahawks. We were on the Great Grey Ghost, it was called, as you probably know, the Albion. Which was a sister but slightly smaller one from the Ark. And the Ark Royal was out